Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by. Change is hard on us, even when it's good change. And that got me thinking about what some of the constants are, or at least the kind of the anchor points, the things that ground us and stabilize us through all that change. And for us as a community, there has, through all of this change, even just venue and whatnot, there has been a constant. And that constant has been the reason that we gather in the first place. I feel like as a community, we know what song we're here to sing. Like, or if you want to make it a little smaller metaphorically, we know which melody or harmony is ours in the greater chorus of spirituality and its communal practices. We know why we're here. We're here to explore what we believe. That's it. That's what we do. And I love that. And I feel so incredibly fortunate to be a part of it. And here's something that I've been reminded of about exploring what we believe over these past few months of change. We can do it anywhere. We don't need anything fancy or expensive to facilitate it. We don't need a single-use space. We don't need a bunch of high-tech tools. Having said that, what we need, and I have the word just in the sentence in my notes, which I feel ambivalent about, but what we need is the willingness to poke around in what we believe with honest hearts and open minds. A bit of peace and quiet are also helpful, but we've learned along the way that we can even explore what we believe when there are some distractions, even quite significant distractions, even the sorts of distractions that we might characterize as ongoing change, right? That kind of disruption. But the fact that, if that's a legitimate set of observations, the fact that exploring what we believe can be done in ways that is relatively simple doesn't mean that it's necessarily easy, does it? Sometimes exploring what we believe is demanding. Sometimes it's tricky. Sometimes it's even frustrating. And sometimes it's exhausting. It can be really difficult. There are many reasons why that might be the case. But one of them is simply that what we believe, what we're here to explore is what we believe, that can cover a lot of ground. And it can have all sorts of implications for how we live our lives. So figuring out how to explore what we believe as well as we can, learning how to use the tools that we have access to, can play a really big part in how that whole experience of exploring what we believe feels. I've probably used this illustration before. If I have, don't let me bore you, but it's a sticky one for me in a good way. My dad, who was a general contractor in a northern community, which means you do everything, general actually means general in a town with 2,500 people in it, used to say, Tim, if you're working, especially with your hands, with materials, it really helps to have the right tools for the job. You're going to be safer, you're going to get more done, and you're probably going to have more fun doing it, and you're going to get a better result. Like, try to have the right tool for the job. Which hasn't turned me into an obsessive tool collector, but I do try to have at least a reasonable approximation of the tool. And it does make a huge difference. So when I was introducing this particular exploration in part one, I said that sometimes the things that we're exploring seem so big and so unwieldy that it's hard to even know where to begin. How do you even start into this? What I believe. That's a big basket, right? That's got a lot of things in it. So how do we get started? How can we not only explore what we believe, but do that in ways that might generate meaningful change in those beliefs and in how we live them out? We talked a little bit about moving, how beautiful questions, this idea that we're exploring, particularly these couple of sessions, how that good questions can move what we're exploring from the realm of ideas into the realm of action. It's one of the things that makes them beautiful in this model. To kind of bring that down to maybe a simpler way to say it, how can we most helpfully question our beliefs? That's bigger picture kind of where we're headed. In part one, I introduced us to the work of the journalist Walter Berger and his idea that we can learn to ask what he calls more beautiful questions. As he defines more beautiful questions, he says those are questions that are both ambitious and actionable. They're the sorts of questions that catalyze change by helping us see and think differently, and that motivates action. See and think differently. I was trying to make this smaller. I'm not sure that helps. Because that's not a small matter, to see and think differently, right? And if that's not enough, seeing differently and thinking differently leads to acting differently, also not a small matter. In all of this, I think as in pretty nearly all of the talky bits that I'm responsible for, I realize, making what might be a rather large assumption, which is that we're exploring what we believe because we're either open to changing some aspect of our beliefs or at the very least open to subjecting what we believe to some serious examination. That if we're part of this community and we stick around, one of my working assumptions is we're open to that. Otherwise, I think we'd be like, time to go shopping, because that seems to be the only thing that happens here, right? So I am making that assumption. And you might not share it, having said all that. And if not, I want to reiterate something that I mentioned in part one, which is Berger's suggestion that, he says it this way, in times of constant change, arguably these days, in times of constant change, the ability to ask big, meaningful, beautiful questions can be the first step in moving beyond old habits and behaviors as we embrace the new. So whether you're open to change or feeling a bit overwhelmed by the constancy of change, being surrounded by big, beautiful questions, learning how to ask big, beautiful questions just might be helpful. That's my hope. So, as I promised in part one, where I want to take us today is into a fairly practical examination of just how we might ask our beliefs more beautiful questions. There's no magic here. There's no quick fixes. But what there is an accessible, learnable method for looking at what we believe in such a way that we're more likely to generate new ways of both thinking and acting, of believing and practicing what we believe. So we're going to get right into that. Where we left off last time, I said I was going to pick up with some thoughts about why we might become less curious and less questioning as we grow older. Not old, just older. Generally speaking, we start out curious, like as human beings. That's in us. If you've ever been around a child anywhere between the ages of 2 to 5, you might have noticed that they ask why a lot. If you're a parent, you might have noticed that it's possible to ask why many times in succession about what appears to be the same topic. Why is that car going so fast? Well, I guess they're in a hurry. Why are they in a hurry? Maybe they have to get to an appointment. Why do they have an appointment? I could keep going. There are some pretty simple, at least discernible, neurobiological reasons for all the whying at this stage. Kids' brain development is in overdrive between those ages. So is their language development. They're starting to figure out what cause and effect is. They're also starting to figure out that adults know a lot, and their natural curiosity motivates them to try to explore that knowledge, and endless questions are an obvious way to do that. So they do it. And then it slows down. And just to be clear, I'm not advocating for us turning back into 2-year-olds sort of toddling around the world endlessly asking why until people around us just want us to go down for our nap already. But I am curious about why we seem to stop being so curious. It can't possibly be, it seems to me, because we've answered all the questions. Although you do occasionally meet someone who gives off that I've got everything figured out vibe. Open question, do you tend to like that person any better than the aforementioned two-year-old? You don't have to answer that. There are some readily discernible reasons why we tend to ask less questions as we go. A lot of them are structural. One of the first reasons is because good questions are often hard to answer, and people don't have the time or patience for them. I know that as a parent, I often ran out of patience long before my kids ran out of curiosity, and I love my kids. So take that equation and apply it to a teacher or an employer whose affection for kid X may not run especially deep, and it kind of makes sense that curiosity might not be encouraged. It takes a lot of time to manage. It takes a lot of energy to manage. And since school is one of the places where asking questions decreases markedly, it's a bit counterintuitive, but frequently measured and shown to be the case, think about what you know, maybe by experience, about the multiple expectations that are placed on an educator, not to mention pragmatic issues like class size, diversity of students, changing curriculum, growing need to provide social education as well as topical education, and that's sort of just the low-hanging fruit. Even if an educator is highly motivated to respond in an encouraging way to a curious student, it's entirely possible that it's difficult for them to do that and meet the core requirements of their job, to get through the things that need to be gotten through. Businesses, places of employment, are often action-oriented, and they view questioning as disruptive and unproductive. Why do you have so many questions? Didn't I tell you what to do? And it doesn't take us long as human beings to figure out if the person at the front, literally or structurally, mostly wants the right answer or compliance. From there, it's a short step to realizing that we can just look that up and regurgitate that, and we get to move on. So those are some of the reasons why we stop being so curious. Here's another reason why we stop being so curious that might have showed up at some point in your religious journey, if a religious journey is part of your story. Questions are usually seen as a challenge to authority and to the status quo. That's why there's an old joke that I've mentioned here before about the kid in Sunday school who, when the teacher asks what runs up a tree and chatters at you, bursts into tears and says, "I know the answer is Jesus, but it sounds like a squirrel." When I was thinking about that again in the context of this, I thought it would be a rare kid who could stand up and say, "I don't care if you think the answer is Jesus. I'm telling you, that's a squirrel." Literally, or as a metaphor for standing in the face of something where we're having one experience and we're being told we're having a different one structurally. We won't take the time to get into this today, but one of the obvious extensions of this is that people in leadership positions, whether those are formal or informal, are both expected to and may themselves expect to have the answers. And questioning can make us, if we're in those positions, feel vulnerable. And when we feel vulnerable, we tend to protect ourselves. We tend to get defensive, which means we tend to shut down questions. So it all kind of makes sense, right? I don't think this needs to be understood as a critique as much as just observable realities that are in these structures and in us as human beings. There's lots more there to explore, but I'm going to move on to some consideration of how we might recover, if you want to use that kind of language, from some of those influences and learn to ask more beautiful questions. Because we're pushing against something when we do this, maybe many somethings. Berger suggests a three-part framework that can foster innovative questioning, like mini models. This one takes something big and complex, carves it down into something easier to remember, and subsequently a bit easier to begin to practice. That's the hope, right? It provides accessibility to this big, unwieldy question. How can we ask more beautiful questions? However, as with other simple models, simple doesn't equal easy. And this can take some practice, especially considering all those kinds of influences that discourage us from asking good questions that we've, gestured toward here in the last few minutes. So for today, what I'm going to do is I'm going to move through the model fairly quickly, and then in some subsequent gatherings, we'll come back to it and we'll work with it in our own contexts. Right? We'll actually plug it in to questions that we might have or circumstances where we've been like, that's not okay. That needs a better answer. All right. So just buckle up. And we'll move through the model here together today. So let's start with a working understanding of what we're dealing with. So our context for the model. And I'm going to say that for our purposes today, the working understanding that I am going to be predicating this on is that we've come across, individually or collectively, we've come across what seems to be a less than ideal situation or a less than ideal or increasingly not working for me or us belief, and we want to seek a better answer. So how might we do that? Three stages. Stage one in this model is to seek understanding by asking why. How about that? We're back to the two-year-old. But unlike the two-year-old, who is almost always stepping toward new knowledge when they ask why, we need to actually start the process of asking beautiful questions by stepping back. And in particular, we need to step back from what we're doing, and we need to ask why we're doing it, or why we're doing it the way we're doing it. So we need to stand back from the action. All right? So that's where this starts. And this is also the step where we stand back from what we think we know. Okay, like I said, simple but not easy, right? Because, man, we like to trust what we think we know. It's reassuring. It's stabilizing to do that. And in this stage, one of the things that we are doing that makes this such a doozy, like right out of the gate, a hard one, is because to do this, we have to acknowledge that we can't always believe what we think. Right? Like that's a conundrum for us as human beings, that maybe our thinking isn't right about something. And even if we don't like right and wrong at that point in the conversation, we might find it more helpful to consider the possibility that our thinking is incomplete. I can remember where I was sitting, in which classroom, in which desk, table I was at when I heard somebody that I regarded as an authority in these matters say, perception is reality. And the philosopher in me immediately objected. But when we unpacked it, I realized that's true. I can only operate in the world as I perceive it. I don't have any other options, and my perceptions are limited, which means my information is limited, which means my thinking is limited. And so at the very least, my thinking is incomplete. It has to be, because I'm human. But that's a disconcerting thing to acknowledge, isn't it? Especially when we kind of formally acknowledge it. So if we continue, and we're still in stage one here, if we continue with this, and I brought a helpful graphic, potentially helpful graphic. See? Why? Seek understanding. Is that helpful? Okay, thank you. Thank you so much. Not original with me, but I chose to bring it, so I'll take a little credit. So as long as we continue in this stage of asking why, we move deeper into it. So the first thing we need to do is step back. Why are we doing this, or why are we doing it the way that we're doing it? And then the next movement inside of this stage is to practice what Berger calls inquiry in context. And this is all pretty intriguing, but this one, you can sort of feel the challenge growing as you go. What inquiry in context means is that as we identify the problem by asking why, we need to then try to do what we can to get close to the problem so we can personally observe and understand the issue in context. Okay, so I just described a process that means that none of the news that we consume meets the criteria, or almost none of it. We will take in very little information in digitally mediated environments for which we actually have the context for that piece of information. And it's impossible for us to get close to all of it. The model actually deals with that problem as we go, but not yet, right? So just the big, we're still at the big end of the funnel here. But if we want to really move into this, we need to do what we can to get the context. I could tell a lot of stories about this personally where I've had an opinion about something, I've thought about something, I've met someone who's lived that something, they've told me their story, and I've realized, oh my goodness, like I really had no foundation of substance for that belief or opinion. I certainly wasn't taking the context adequately into account. I didn't know it. Doesn't excuse me, but it might help me understand, right? And so, yeah. Challenging stuff. I think that in the model that we're talking about here, this is one of the more difficult maneuvers, honestly. it does provide a bit of a, I'll use an old-fashioned image here, a bit of a winnowing process, a bit of a separating the good stuff from the less good stuff, or the usable stuff from the less usable stuff. That we start to make choices pretty early on in this process, where we go, where am I going to put my energy for knowing context? And can I separate my questioning, when I'm questioning my beliefs, can I separate the things I'm questioning where I have or am able to have context from those where I'm not able to gather context? Can I set aside the ones for which I can't have an adequate context and say, I don't have enough information about that to ask it a beautiful question? I have to stay with generic questions for that, right? So again, you can see how the process kind of works its way down. After inquiry and context, we move on to refining and deepening our questions. So I was sort of gesturing toward that already. So what we do as we go along is we start to get clearer about what we're going to pursue in more detail. I remember the first time in an academic context where somebody explained to me that in their doctorate work, they were required to make a unique contribution to their field of study. And in their experience, that meant they had to know more and more about less and less. They needed this niche where they could say, here's a new idea. And it takes these other ideas that are part of this discipline into that's my context, right? So it's an interesting illustration of this process. So we need to move on to refining our and deepening our questions. One of my favorite ways to do that is something we've done here at the table. It's an exercise called the five whys, where you ask of whatever you're questioning, you ask why. And then when you get an answer to that one, you ask that answer, why. And then when you get an answer to that question, you ask that answer, why. You do five layers of that, you will work your way into that question at a deeper level. It's sort of like being a two-year-old who has breaks. So it's five whys, it's not endless whys, right? But we want to dig in. And also at this stage, it can be helpful to challenge assumptions, including ours. If we didn't grow up around more Eastern belief systems and spiritualities, this idea has leaked its way into more Western ways of thinking. This is where adopting a beginner's mind can be really helpful, right? Knowing that we don't know can help us go a long way towards seeing things with a childlike, not childish, but childlike curiosity. And basically the way I would define that is a curiosity that's open to all the possibilities. And this is also the part of the process where we question our questions to try to surface our own underlying assumptions and our biases. We all have them. We just don't necessarily want to face that fact, which is why this is part of the process. It insists, if we're working with the process, that we do that. That we actually kind of go, where's my bias showing up here? What are my assumptions? And you don't have to be Jungian. You don't have to swallow everything that Carl Jung handed us whole to see pretty easily evidence in our human behavior that the things that we don't know consciously have an enormous amount of power in our lives. This starts to get to kind of peel the onion. It starts to get us to the things that are actually often driving our behavior that we don't even know we believe. They're not conscious beliefs. They're just kind of baked in. And a lot of those things were baked in when we were 2 to 5. Right? And they're pretty deep inside our psyche, but they are actually what's motivating us intrinsically when we behave the way we behave. So this starts to kind of help us get to some of that stuff as a process. And then finally, stage one still, we need to take ownership of our own questions. And not everyone's going to appreciate our line of inquiry. I think when I look around this room and I think about the people's stories that I do know, I can think of any number of instances where we have inquired about something that had to do with belief and met with resistance in that inquiry, sometimes quite stern resistance with institutional muscles, right? This we can get pushback. Taking ownership of our own questions can help us navigate the terrain of those who might prefer or feel compelled to defend the status quo, who would rather we weren't asking the question. And also, honest inquiry means being open to being challenged by others. That's part of what makes it honest. So when there is pushback, instead of defending ourselves, remember the busy educator, right? Busy questioner, same dynamic in a lot of ways. Instead of being defensive because we feel vulnerable when our process is questioned, a good process encourages us to be open to the challenge and to consider it. There might be something here I need to pay attention to. It may not be what the person is saying. We don't have to take their position to be open to being challenged by it, right? So validation is not agreement, is the terrain that I'm trying to describe here in a lot of ways. We can be like, I need to think about that. I might not want to, but it would be a good part of the process if I did. So that's stage one, right? Asking why. And we move from there to stage two, which is a different sort of, if we want it in a one-word question, is asking what. And when we ask what we're doing is we're imagining possibilities. This is the part of the process where nothing is impossible. All right. So at this stage, this is sort of like that brainstorming, no bad ideas. You know, it's that kind of a space. There's no wrong answers at this stage in the process. And, you know, for the more considered and evaluative among us, don't panic. Like, we're going to parse all of this shortly. But first, we need to stir the pot. And we can do that in Berger's model in three different ways. The first is something that he calls connective inquiry. And this is basically where we gather various viewpoints that pertain to our question. And then we mix up seemingly unrelated ideas. And we'll kind of come to this process again in his method. Remember, we're not refining just yet. This can all seem a little bit nonsensical at first, but we stay with it. So what happens first is we practice connective inquiry. We say, what about this relative to that? What about this relative to that? If I believed this or went this direction, how would it imp-? And we just put the bits up against one another and see how they push on one another. And then what we do with all of that, which can be quite a muddle, is we basically take it for a walk. We take those ideas and we let them incubate, is the word that he likes. We let them perk. Man, a lot of the ideas of history that have been real game changers have come from people who took the time to take them literally for a walk, to sit with them. I could be wrong, I might be misremembering this, but Rowanna, I think it was you that mentioned recently sort of being exposed to the idea that 10 minutes a day looking at something where we can't see anything that a human has made, did that count? Yeah, right? Can be quite, well, grounding, centering, freeing in other ways, right? I've been practicing that since you mentioned it. It was a sticky idea for me, and I realized that I have the great good fortune of my office window meeting that criteria, which is not something everyone can say, but that it is actually quite hard to find that space in some ways. So even just that's incubation time in a lot of ways, right? That's us sort of taking all of these possibilities and just sitting with them. Berger also suggests that the time right before we fall asleep might be a time for this. And I wasn't sure how I felt personally about that suggestion. It would land differently with different people depending on your relationship with sleep, for sure. But his point is that, and this is sort of the brain science of it, is that when we are relaxing into sleep, assuming that that's part of our process for going to sleep, the right brain, left brain connectivity is especially easy. Einstein sort of famously, you know, holding a pencil and that moment right before you nod off and drop the pencil, that's where you make a note. That's where the crosstalk is really going off, right? So that's the same idea. Let them incubate. And that leads us to the last idea for this stage, which is to jumble our brains on purpose. Now, you might be feeling like your brain's plenty jumbled already. Thank you very much. And that, I get that. I can appreciate that. What Berger is after here is forcing our brain to be a bit more open by thinking of nonsensical ideas or unusual combinations of ideas. So this sort of builds on that previous connective inquiry idea, right? Takes it a little further. That process of deliberately jumbling our brains can trigger new neural synapse and it can loosen old ones. We can think about it like it's like training our what-if muscles. I don't know how many of you have ever had the privilege of working with a strong creative team. I've gotten to work with more than one over the course of my work life. And also our kids, our biological kids, just the creativity, the connections that get made sometimes are just like, seriously, how did you put those together? And that's this process on purpose, right? Deliberately putting things side by side that we think have nothing to do with one another and seeing how they what happens to the ideas in the process. So that's the second stage. Third stage, almost there. Stay with me. Third stage is moving from what if to how. So why, what if, and then how. And this is where we do that refinement that I was talking about a little bit earlier. The way Berger articulates it is by saying, out of all these possibilities that we've been tossing around when we ask a question about why we're doing something or why we're doing it the way we're doing it, what we do is we zoom in on one of the possible answers and then we start to ask, what would it take, one of the possible ways to change, rather, and we start to ask, what would it take to make that one possibility happen? And once again, there are steps within the stage. We start by deciding which idea or ideas we want to commit to. And the commitment part's an important part of the process. And then, and this is really important, and a part we often, at least I often, tend to skip because I live in my head so much, then we need to give it form. And what we mean by that is we need to find a way to get it out of our head and into the material world. That might mean making some notes. It might mean making a sketch, creating a prototype, making a video, anyway, something that we can share and that we can get feedback on, something that we can actually move around in the world and test. Tyrion's working on an album of solo instrumental music at the moment. He's just finishing up. He's doing the mixing. It's all recorded. The recording's all done. And the mixing part is new to him. The recording part he's familiar with, but he hasn't spent a lot of time mixing. And so he did mixes of all this stuff, and he was incredibly meticulous about that, spent a lot of time on it, and was not satisfied. And so he sent the mixes out to some people that weren't familiar with the music, but who were musicians and who played other instruments than him, whose opinions he respected, and asked for their feedback. And he got feedback. They had opinions about those mixes, which, you know, he had to be open to that as part of the process. And so that was challenging. He had to go back and address himself to quite a number of things. And he would say the mixes got better, right? So it's that kind of a process. The next inside step in this stage is to fail forward. And just a little note here, this is not the same thing as failing upward, which is a term that's sometimes used to critique the way people get promoted because of connections and privilege rather than, you know, competence or merit. Mm-hmm. In our context, failing forward could also be understood to mean normalizing failure. Trying something, seeing what works and what doesn't, and then learning from our mistakes. Iteration is another sort of fancy word that gets used in this space for this, right? I think I've mentioned this before in this context, but one of the games that sometimes gets used in this space is where you give people a bunch of pieces of spaghetti and some tape and some string, and the group has to build the tallest freestanding tower they can in a certain number of minutes. And this game is played all over the world. There's a big database about how long it takes groups and how high they build things. And the most successful group categorically is kindergartners, because they iterate without ego. If they try something and it doesn't work, they're just like, well, let's just try something else. And they just try something else. And that's the path to success in that particular kind of challenge. That's part of what Berger's trying to talk about here. He's like, you pick one, you focus in on it, you externalize it, you make it real in the world, and you test it, and you observe what works and what doesn't, and then you adjust it, and you test it again. Now, when we're talking about beliefs, that's very tidy. And as an illustration, as a method, beliefs, yeah, right? Not so tidy. Let me pick an example. As a parent with, you know, four adult kids, three of whom are queer, I might have grown up in religious spaces where, like, that's not okay, right? My beliefs have certainly changed a great deal about that over the years. Not everybody around me has changed their beliefs about that over the years. So how do you test that change in belief? And how does the test go? Well, the test might, even if you did the same test with a bunch of people, you're not going to get the same responses, are you? We're not all going to be fortunate enough to get my mom's beautiful response of, well, I don't understand, but I just love them, for instance, right? We might get any number of more challenging responses than that in that instance. So this is complicated stuff, but it also makes sense that if we're actually going to change what we believe and then have our actions reflect that change, we do need to test this in the real world. We need to actually put it out there. I think I'm making an assumption here that I should articulate, which is we need to do this in ways that are as safe as they can be, both for us and for others. And that's part of the complexity, isn't it? This is not just like flip a switch and do a thing. There's relationships, there's history, there's all kinds of things that surround all of these tests, aren't there? Nevertheless, if we want to fail forward, that's part of the process. We do need to figure out what this looks like enacted if we change a belief, and what the implications are, and can we live with that? And lastly, this is a lot, right? We need to practice what Berger calls collaborative inquiry. When I came across this in the method, I thought, well, this is just made for the table. What Berger means is that in this part of the process, we share our questions and we connect with other people who may have either faced similar challenges or who may have even come up with answers to some of the questions that we're working on. We're not necessarily, in this part of the process, we're not necessarily looking to others for answers for us. We are inquiring about their answers so that those answers can take us to a new level of questions and exploration. So they're catalytic, not decisive, if that is helpful at all, right? We're inviting the sharing of answers to shared questions to inform our questioning process, to inform our own beautiful questions and what we might do as action out of all of this. All right. I'm going to stop there. If you're feeling like you tapped out a while ago, don't worry. We're going to work with these ideas some more. And when they do, I think we'll find, like is often the case with new ideas, they start to settle in and they start to feel less daunting when we practice them, when we do them. For now, let me suggest that we just remember, that when we come across something that needs to be better, the whole process starts by giving ourselves permission to act like a 2-year-old and ask why. Peace.